Howdy there, friends, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. I'm Cam Hale. As always, with me in studio is mi amigo, Mr. Philly O'Filson. Philly, how are you feeling over there?
Man, I still got this nasty head cold. I can't seem to shake it. My voice sounds deep. I feel like John B. Wells. You know, he does that narration of the like the UFO shows and
yes.
stuff, UFO case files.
Man, I'm feeling you. I've been on some antibiotics now. I got this stuff. We came back from Arkansas. It's because we handled that piece of metal.
I think it was the Star Child skull that gave it to me.
You think it was? I think it was that piece of metal we both handled with no gloves that allegedly fell from a UFO. I think that's the problem. At least I know that's what's going on with me because I've had that grass growing. I believe it was Kat said that it's like a creep show where you touch the meteorite where Stephen King has the grass looking stuff growing out of him and the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's what's happening in my lungs right now.
That's what it feels like, right?
Right.
I can't shake this thing and it's like raining all the time.
Folks, just bear with us. We're trying to get through this. Speaking of bear, I got a story for you, Philly.
Yep.
We're going to jump right into this whole thing. It's always been said in the circles of hunters that a boar, a wild boar, or a hog, or a pig, or however you want to talk about it, was called the poor man's grizzly bear because of the ferocity that these things could honestly have, you know, and I know people that's been hurt by them and things like that. This comes from The Independent. Now, I'd first heard about this story listening on Joe Rogan's podcast about a week ago. They had brought it up, so I got to looking into this. Folks, get a load of this. It's something I never thought about. Radioactive wild boar rampaging around Fukushima nuclear site.
What?
Yeah, it says that the animal population has gone unchecked since 2011 when the disaster struck. Now, it says that the boar are running wild and breeding uncontrollably in the northern region of Japan contaminated by the Fukushima event. It says the animals have been devastating local agriculture and eating toxic nuclear contaminated food from around the accident site. Mass graves and incinerators have been unable to cope with a quantity of boar corpses shot by local hunters. Now they go on to say a quarantine zone near the Fukushima nuclear plant where the 2011 meltdown leaked the material all around there has been uninhabited since for humans completely. But the boars stayed, of course, in that area unchecked. Now it says their precise numbers unknown. But since 2014, says a number of them have been hunted, and they believe that it's increased from 3,000. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
To 13,000.
Really?
Now, we all know here, excuse me, folks, we all know here in Texas, we've got a huge problem with them.
Yeah, we're overrun with them.
Yeah, it's madness. And once they start in like this, it's tough to deal with. I can only imagine what's going to happen to the farmland in Japan if they don't get their hands on it. Not to mention what Joe brought up and they laughed about on his show was, what if there's some sort of elevated, due to this radioactivity, elevated like intelligence or something that could possibly come from these boar? What if they become immune to a lot of things or maybe smarter or, you know, who knows? It's just funny to think about. But it does say that the damage to local farms beyond that quarantine zone caused by these hogs are amounted to about 98 million yen.
Wow.
Yeah. So that says the animals are now being killed faster than they can be buried, like they talked about. Now there's mass grave. Says that some of them are big enough for 600 boar apiece, and that's about 35 miles from the nuclear plant. The problem is with this. Here's the real issue is you can kill one, and you can't eat it. Nobody benefits from it.
Right.
But you've got to stop them from destroying the farmland. And what are you going to do with them now? Suno Sato is a local hunter, and he says, sooner or later, we're going to have to ask local people to give us their land to use. The city doesn't own land which isn't occupied by houses. What he's referring to is places to bury them. Like they said also, they're getting desperate, so they've been using incinerators to burn them up. But they said it's difficult to find workers who are willing to chop up their remains to put into the furnaces. So it sounds like this whole thing is a huge trouble that they never, ever, ever thought about. Now, I knew that there were stories about the wolves that are out there and all this. So you can only imagine, completely left, unchecked. There's no hunting. There's no nothing going on around there. It's turning into the true wild in that area. And who knows what's going to happen as far as the evolution of these creatures while this radioactivity is going on.
Well, I know it can take care of them. We need to get these robots. Did you see this?
Uh-oh.
A new 3D printing technique from MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory has allowed researchers to print all of the parts of a robot, both solid parts like the body and liquid components such as the hydraulic pumps, at the same time. The result is both incredible and terrifying.
Oh, no.
It says that the researchers were able to print fully assembled robots without any human intervention needed at all. It says all you have to do is stick in a battery and a motor, and you'll have a robot that'll practically walk right out of the printer.
Oh, great. So now that DARPA can print their own robots and then teach robots to print other robots, and phase three has begun.
Now, this little six-legged robot depicted in MIT's video that they have up on YouTube about the project can crawl. It uses 12 hydraulic pumps embedded within its tiny little body, meaning it has both solid and liquid parts. It weighs about 1.5 pounds, and it's about 0.5 foot long. They say that the challenge in 3D printing liquids is that it can be very messy, and it's difficult to harden the solid portions of a structure without also affecting the liquid ones. Now, one of the ways that MIT researchers overcame this problem was by using a printer that has 8 different printer heads, which can deposit different kinds of materials onto the structure at the same time. They said that it gives us a very fine control of material placement, which allows us to print complex, pre-filled, fluidic channels.
That's a mouthful.
Right? They say one drawback of the method is that it took about 22 hours to print the little guy, but in the future, MIT researchers hope to improve these printing times, likely by improving the printers themselves. They say that one day the team envisions many potential applications, like killing radioactive boar.
Right, yeah.
They say that including disaster relief in dangerous environments. They say that many nuclear sites, for example, need to be remediated to reduce their radiation levels. Unfortunately, the sites are lethal to humans, but they can get these printable robots that can be quickly dispersed and fabricated right there at the site to clean things up. It's crazy, right? It's pretty crazy. They're saying that now we're at the infancy of machines capable of creating other machines. Now, this is what we're always talking about on this show, right? It is Skynet. It's happening.
Nice knowing y'all, folks.
Right?
It was fun. It was fun. However, we were all humans and we were the ones in control of this planet. That was awesome. That didn't last as long as we had hoped. Yeah, you're right. Look, I love the idea of creating them for the cleanup and the help and, you know, and all that stuff whenever there's disasters. But we all know that's not where it's going to stop. We all know it's going to get crazy.
Well, sure. That's what we talk about. Any tool like a hammer, for example. Mm-hmm. You can do a lot with a hammer. You can build stuff with a hammer. You can build a home. You can also kill somebody with a hammer.
You can also bash their skull in.
Right. Yeah, so right. These robots, of course, they can be used for good. But when they're used for evil, that's when you have to watch out, right?
Yeah. And boars. And so we're going to have radioactive Godzilla pigs and DARPA Terminator robots fighting it out in Japan. Funny how that always ended up in Japan, right? Isn't that where this whole thing started?
It's exactly the same thing as the Terminator films.
Yeah.
Godzilla is radioactive, right?
Oh, here we go.
You know Godzilla lives right off the Fukushima prefecture, right?
Oh, yeah. He's got to, right? He has to. I got you something here I think you're going to enjoy. Get out your pen, folks. And Kyle loves to look all this stuff up. There was a Netherlands UFO witness recounts a military encounter. Now, this made me think because when we were up there in Arkansas, we'd listened to David Marler speak on this. Some different military encounter stuff. So case number 74907 of the Mutual UFO Network. This is in the witness database. Basically, there is a witness from Sosterburg in the Netherlands that recounted a little encounter from 1991. It says that left him traumatized. It says February 17th of 91 at about 3 a.m. He was actually on a night shift watch at the military base walking around outside. It says along with another cadet, I came to the central parking lot at 3 a.m. and saw a big circle in the sky straight on top of us. It had no shape, but only bright light slowly rotating counterclockwise, and the light points itself didn't rotate. The colors were in a liquid manner. Now, the witness said he wondered how large it was. We couldn't tell exactly. He estimates it around 30 to 50 meters in diameter. So the first thing we both thought was a blimp. A Zeppelin, the one like Goodyear has, with the lights and the screens on the side. But the fact was that it's very low and absolutely stationary, and it was silent, which made it very, very odd. Now, it said that soon the object began to rotate. It says after some minutes, the lights started to rotate faster, and suddenly it took off at a very incredible speed to the west. A couple of seconds later, it says we felt short, hard wind blowing, which stayed on top of us like the downwash from a helicopter. Now, they had a clear view of the object. He goes on to state that if there was a way to describe the speed that this thing was going, he said, I can't do it. So we had a clear view for over 30 kilometers or 20 miles plus looking at it. said the thing covered that distance from stationary to there in something like 10 seconds. Says, I know aviation and I have flying experience. I'm sorry, 0.10 seconds. He said this extreme acceleration turns a human into liquid. Now, the witness waited 25 years before coming forward. Says, for many years, this has been an unspoken chapter in my life. I didn't want to speak about the incident because instantly after the encounter, me and the other cadet became unexplainably very, very ill and for days suffered a high fever and extreme vomiting. The illness was so bad that it left me traumatized and not able to speak about it for years. Now, what do you think about that? Now, we've had other people always talk about when they have some sort of encounter, something, it always seems to leave them physically ill. Is that what the ship puts off? Is it something when it blasted off? Maybe that's what it is. Is it some, and I'm not even saying radiation, maybe it's some sort of disruption in the energy that what it uses.
Yeah.
Is makes you ill.
I don't know, but that is a common thread that happens in a lot of UFO sightings. So there has to be something there. Speaking about extraterrestrials, there's been a recently new development in the WOW signal. Do you remember the WOW signal? We've talked about it before on the show.
We talked about it a week or so ago when you couldn't make it, when I was on Micah's show.
Oh, yeah?
We discussed it. Yeah, that they were trying to bounce something off of a comet. They thought it was a comet that they could get the sound
off. Yeah,
it's
actually a guy that we've had on the show before, Antonio Paris. Yeah, they say back in 1977, astronomer Jerry Iman was using Ohio State University's Big Ear radio telescope to sweep the sky for possible signals from extraterrestrial civilizations when he found something. Now, while pointing towards a group of stars called the Chi Sagittari on the 15th of August, he received a powerful blast of radio waves that lasted for 72 seconds. He circled in on the readout and wrote, "Wow." Now, analysis of the signal showed that it displayed all the hallmarks of coming from interstellar space, and it became something very big for those involved in SETI. Now, that's, of course, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. They thought for the first time, Cam, that they actually found a signal being broadcast from interstellar space. The trouble is that despite numerous attempts, the signal was never observed again, and so it remains unexplained. So, you know, using the scientific method, you have to be able to reproduce your findings in order for it to be proven. That's the problem. They never were able to find this signal again. It was a one-time thing. They received it. It's on a printout. They have proof that he received it, but they've never been able to locate it again. But now our friend Antonio Paris, who of St. Petersburg College in Florida, he's got a new theory. He said that he has an investigative background, and so when he decided to approach this WOW signal, it's like going back to a crime scene. He said it was a cold case, so when I went to various astronomical databases to find possible culprits or suspects, that was like this virtual crime scene. He said that it turns out, they didn't know this at the time, but there was two comets that were in the area where that broadcast was received, and if his theory is correct, which he'll be able to produce when he does the test again, because these comets are going to be coming back around very soon. One was going to be on the 25th of January of 2017, and the other comet will be visible again on January 7th of 2018. He'll be able to prove if that signal is he's able to replicate that burst, that radio wave that was received. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Problem is, it's not easy to get use of radio telescopes. He says all the radio telescopes in North America and beyond are fully booked. So he's actually launched a crowdfunding campaign on GoFundMe trying to raise the money to buy his own radio telescope that he'll be able to make these observations and prove that this WOW signal actually was, in fact, these comets. Now, there are people and other astronomers that don't like this idea. They're like, no, that's not what it was. It definitely wasn't these comets. And he's got a good attitude about it. He's like, look, if I'm wrong, it's not a big deal. I still come out with a radio telescope.
That's right.
And I can use that to look further into other things. But he thinks that's what it is. And it does sound like that might be what's responsible. Now, if you would like to donate to help him, I went to the GoFundMe page today. He's trying to raise $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
And he's almost there. He was like at $17,975. But if you'd like to contribute to Antonio and trying to prove that this WOW signal really is these comets or, in fact, it was an extraterrestrial trying to reach out to us, you can go to that GoFundMe page. Look at the show notes, and I'll have links to it in there.
That's pretty awesome. I mean, and we discussed it on there with Mike. It's one of those things. I don't know if you could recreate it. I said a bunch of stuff. I can't remember what all I said. I'm I'm foggy from all the meds I'm on. Go check out Micah's last 2 weeks ago show when he was down here and we discussed it. I think I had some more intelligent stuff to say. I don't know that I got it in me right now, but I do have something for all of our friends and fans and Waz and Chris and Bill and everybody down in Australia. I don't know what's going on down there, but recently a Victoria resident claims that they had an encounter with a Bigfoot-like creature.
A yowie.
A yowie. Now, of course, this is cryptozoology news, so take it for what it's worth. But still, folks, this man claims that he recently saw an 8-foot bipedal creature in Southeast Australia. Now, he provided his full name, it says, but requested to remain anonymous. But he said that this past Saturday, he was hiking on the Mount Pilot when he spotted the undetermined creature. And it says, I was looking for a photography opportunity. I was walking alone up the trail. There were trees on either side, and it was approaching dark. Further up the trail, I heard a large animal moving through the undergrowth. Now, the man, a 26-year-old store owner, said that the animal just suddenly appeared, run across the trail, and disappeared. Now, he said, to him, it looked to be an 8-foot creature walking on two legs with long arms and a short neck. Now, he did say that the entire body was covered in a shaggy brown hair and that it resembled a gorilla. Now, he says that the sighting only lasted about 10 seconds and he wasn't able to pull up his camera and get a picture of it. Shocker. But now, like we said, there's also been some issues that they talk about this, that there was a controversial video taken by a pair of self-proclaimed Yowie researchers in Australia that says captured the attention of millions of viewers across the globe. The footage, which showed what looked like a large primate eating apples from a tree, was also allegedly taken at night. Now, in 2015, the man in charge of the Yowie Listening Project reported to Cryptozoology News and that he believed that the video was not real. And additionally, he said that the researcher presented recorded audio of what he suspected to be the cryptid's voice. And he went on to say that I do not support the alleged Yowie video. I am aware of the authors and wish no association with them. I can't stress how highly elusive these creatures are. They won't dance for apples under an IR light. Now, hopefully we can get to the bottom of it, but it's about data. Scientists don't want blurry photos. Top people here are open to the evidence after reviewing collected data. We know what they want for a serious look. It's just a matter of getting it. Now, that's what he said last year. I like the way he says all that because it reminds me of what Waz and them are doing and Chris down there in Australia with the Thylacine Research Project.
Right?
It reminds me of that because, look, they don't want photos. They don't want all this stuff. They want hard data. We already know. And after going to Arkansas and listening to what they also, photos really don't mean a thing.
Not it's anymore. Not with Photoshop. No, I mean, can you see the stuff you can do with Photoshop now?
Yes. I've been going through it. Look, it's unbelievable.
It's different compared to a long time ago.
It's
nowadays,
not the same.
You can't believe an image that you see.
No, you can't. And so you have to have hard evidence. You have to have a body. You have to have a DNA. You have to have something that is physical evidence that you can hold and not a photograph. Or not like an audio recording, something. I mean, that can kind of sprinkle the breadcrumbs, but that's not what you need. So at least people are beginning now to get away from the romantic allure, it seems, and start taking more of a scientific approach to trying to find these answers.
I like the Yowie. If you live in Australia, I know we have lots of fans in Australia. If you live in Australia and you had a Yowie sighting or an encounter yourself, please email us at the show. I mean, I would love to read those. I find those stories fascinating.
Yeah.
We're covered up with them in North America, but you know, when you get them from other parts of the world, it seems to me that somehow it seems more interesting.
I love it. And also, too, all the pictures that y'all can take of the biggest, deadliest, hairiest spiders, please send them. Kyle loves. You can post them on Facebook. You can send them to expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. Kyle loves them.
What's wrong with you?
He has them for his screensaver on his computer. The biggest, scariest spiders you can find, folks. If you could ever get one and freeze it or put it in acrylic and send it to him, he'd use it as a paperweight.
Right. Well, speaking of forwarding us pictures and news stories, I got a ton of these this week, and I appreciate everybody for sending them to us. We just did a recent episode about these stone spheres. You remember those?
Yes,
found a giant one. I know that you saw it, too. They say in the middle of the outskirts of Zavidovici, Bosnia, an archaeologist named Samir Osmanagic has discovered a very large, very round rock with a radius between 4 and 5 feet, making this the largest stone sphere ever discovered. So that's pretty cool. I mean, we had just done an episode on these stone spheres.
Right.
Here they are. 2 weeks later, they find a giant one, the biggest one on the planet. Now, again, this has brought up these stone spheres again, where people are talking about how, oh, those aren't real. That's, you know, those things can form naturally. through concretion. But, you know, I don't think so. It looks like this thing's man-made to me, right?
Well, some of them look like they could possibly have human intervention on the stones, even the ones that I had discussed. But some of them also look like they were formed naturally, maybe through a large flood, maybe through a lot of water. Yeah.
They said that, unfortunately, we brought it up on that show when we did it, that during the 1970s, a lot of them were cracked open because people thought they'd have gold or they might be like geodes or something.
Yes.
There's nothing in them. They're just giant stone spheres, I think, from an ancient culture that developed these. And who knows why? I mean, like we were joking about on that episode, maybe they're just lawn ornaments. Who knows?
Yeah.
But the biggest one ever has just been found. So I thought that was very cool. I know lots of people shared that with us. I appreciate it. If you have your own news stories you'd like to share with the show, please send them our way. Well, let's take a break. And when we get back from the break, we're going to do something a little different. We haven't ever really crossed this barrier before. But I think you're going to like this. We're going to be talking about the vampire of Sincota. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. There have been many notorious serial killers throughout history. Most of them are well known, like the Zodiac Killer, Jeffrey Dahmer, John Wayne Gacy, Richard Speck, Ted Bundy, and perhaps the most famous, Jack the Ripper. Many of their terrible acts are so disturbing and sickening, and yet we are fascinated by their motivations. Most serial killers are very intelligent, well-spoken, and some are very attractive. Based on recent FBI crime statistics, there are approximately 15,000 murders annually in the United States, and only a portion of them are the work of a serial killer. The FBI estimates that there are between 25 and 50 serial killers currently operating throughout the United States at any given time. Serial killers become famous for their terrible deeds. Some of them are even displayed on trading cards and have a cult-like following. But today, we are going to be talking about one of history's least known and most heinous serial killers, Bela Kish, the monster of Sincota. Kish is believed to have killed approximately 24 women in Hungary back in the early 20th century, and his motives behind these vicious killings, to some degree, still remains a mystery. Bela Kish was born in Hungary in 1877 and lived in the small town of Sincota, just outside Budapest. Very little is known about his childhood. It is assumed that it was fairly normal. Around 1912, at the age of 35, he moved to Budapest and worked as a horse farrier and a tinsmith. Kish was regarded as extremely good-looking, with a full head of blonde hair and extremely piercing blue eyes. Not only was he charming, according to some of his neighbors, but also he was known to be a great conversationalist, especially in the manner in which he interacted with the citizens of Sincota. Kish also managed to become well-educated without any formal schooling. He was known to be an avid reader and had an extensive knowledge of ancient history, literature, and art. He also showed a fascination with astrology palm readings, and the occult. Quiche was generally well-liked in town, and on occasion would host large parties at the nearby hotel where he would invite the locals. His generosity was renowned, and with his dashing good looks, it was quite apparent that he was quite the catch for any single woman in search of a would-be husband. He did marry at one point to a woman named Marie, who was approximately 15 years his junior. Their marriage was very short-lived. During their first year of marriage, Mary had already grown tired of Quiche and became romantically involved with a young artist named Paul Beccari. The affair only lasted around 3 weeks, and when both Marie and Paul went missing, Quiche claimed the two of them split town and left for the United States. Sadly, it was later learned that Marie would become one of Quiche's first victims. It still isn't clear if finding his wife in the arms of another man is what sparked Quiche's rampage in the first place. With his wife now out of the picture, Quiche hired a housekeeper to take care of his home in Sikota while he moved to an apartment in nearby Budapest. Quiche began setting out to find a new woman, but there weren't many single women living in the town of Sikota at the time. So in order to find a more suitable companion, Quiche rented an apartment and began posting advertisements in the local newspaper. Some accounts claim that he visited Budapest's numerous brothels in search of women. Apparently, Quiche was a very popular customer among the local prostitutes. Yet, interestingly enough, none of them wound up being any of his victims. The newspaper ads seemed to be working well for Quiche, and numerous women answered the advertisement. The townspeople noticed the appearance of Quiche's many female guests, with many of the men in town even envying Quiche's success with women. To his neighbors, Quiche just seemed to keep his affairs private, and he kept his female visitors at a distance, never offering to introduce any of them to his neighbors or his housekeeper. Not only did Quiche's advertisements help him meet single women, they were also instrumental in helping him find potential victims. In one of the most horrendous and still baffling crimes in history, Quiche's neighbors had no idea that a monstrous serial killer lived in their town and that he was attempting to lure women with a fraudulent promise of marriage and security, and in the end, strangling them and hiding the bodies on his property. In addition to the number of women who began visiting Quiche at his home in Sikota, several townspeople began to notice that he was collecting large metal drums at the back of his property. His neighbors, becoming suspicious, were under the impression that Quiche was illegally storing liquor or a variety of other substances in these drums. When a local police officer came to question Quiche about the drums, Quiche mentioned that as war clouds were looming, he was taking an initiative and filling the drums with gasoline with the intention of later rationing it in the near future. Quiche also reassured the officer that he wasn't keeping anything else in the drums, such as liquor. Well, apparently the policeman was satisfied with Quiche's response, and the issue was never brought up again. Meanwhile, in Budapest, attention was brought to the mysterious disappearance of two women, both of them widows, with the last names of Varga and Schmeddiak, who had been sighted at different times with a young man named Hoffman. World War I eventually arrived, and Quiche had a military background, having performed mandatory service in the Austro-Hungarian Army in the 1890s. After his military stint, he remained a member of the Hungarian Reserves. Now, at the start of the war, Kiss was drafted into the Royal Hungarian Landwehr, where he was assigned to the 40th Honved Infantry Brigade. While in the war, Kiss's brigade suffered extreme casualties when they fought against the Russians in the Carpathian Mountains in Central and Eastern Europe. It was on July of 1916 that Kiss's landlord went to inspect the house to determine whether any repairs were needed prior to renting it out in Kiss's absence. It was then that he, the landlord, discovered the metallic drum stored outside of the house. Perplexed as to why the drums were there, the landlord attempted to open one of them. As his efforts proved fruitless, he punctured one of them and was overwhelmed by a terrible and atrocious odor. He approached a neighbor who happened to be a chemist. He came over and inspected the drums and informed the landlord that the smell he was smelling was that of decomposing flesh. The landlord immediately called the police. The chief detective of Budapest Police Department was a man named Dr. Charles Nagy, and he quickly arrived on the scene after receiving a distressed phone call from the landlord. He explained that he owned the property and had rented it out to a soldier named Béla Kiss, but he had not been heard of since the start of the war. The landlord informed Nagy that Kiss was believed to have been captured by the enemy or even possibly killed in the war. Either way, Kiss was behind on his rent, and the landlord had stopped by in order to inspect the property so that he could rent it out to new tenants. After inspecting the scene, Nagy called for backup, and soon other detectives arrived and started opening one of the other drums. What they found inside was the body of a naked young woman who had been strangled with a rope. In fact, the rope still remained noosed around her neck. Once the other drums were opened, the police discovered 7 bodies within these drums, all of which had been preserved in wood alcohol, commonly known as methanol, which is used to create the embalming agent formaldehyde. The bodies were all well preserved or pickled and showed no signs of deterioration, leading the police to believe that they would be easy to identify. As the police spread out from the house and searched the town, approximately 17 more drums were found at different spots throughout Senkota. Some of them were in Kiss's cellar and woodshed, each one containing the preserved corpse of a naked and strangled young woman. A mortician was brought in to perform an examination of the bodies, with one report claiming that each victim had small puncture wounds on their necks, implying that they had been drained of their blood. The search uncovered the remains of 24 young women. Some of them had been buried on the property, with some accounts claiming that they were stored in a small shed and stacked like firewood. Among the dead were Kiss's wife, Marie, and of course her lover, Paul Bakari, Kiss's only male victim. All the other bodies the police found were those of women. It is believed that Kiss had bashed his wife's skull in first and then strangled her, with the same set of circumstances befalling Paul Bakari. Nagy and his team were convinced that Kiss had probably killed up to 30 women at this point. Now beginning to panic a little, Dr. Nagy sent out an urgent request to the military to find Kiss and have him detained immediately. If Kiss was serving on the front lines, it was very likely that he could be apprehended and brought in for questioning. However, Further complications ensued. The names Bella and Kis, unfortunately, were extremely common names in Hungary, which led Nagy to believe that there were numerous soldiers in the military who had the same name as the alleged killer. Even though the bodies were fairly well preserved due to the wood alcohol, actually identifying the victims would prove quite a challenge for the local police. Once the drums were opened and the bodies exposed, a more in-depth examination of the containers provided some valuable clues. Nagy discovered two sets of initials with the letter K and V that had been embroidered on one of the victims' clothes, and the initials M and T, also embroidered on a handkerchief. A search of Keisha's bedroom, as well as his entire house, provided no immediate clues, yet one locked door in the house would eventually provide a more important find. When Nagy asked her about the room, a flustered housekeeper, known as Miss Jakubek, claimed that she knew nothing about what lay beyond the locked door. She informed the detectives that Kis specifically told her never to enter that room, so she didn't. And not satisfied with her answer, Nagy took the key from her, unlocked the door, and entered the secret room. Once inside, they discovered several bookcases, as well as a desk, that when searched, held volumes of letters and correspondence with close to 100 women, as well as a large photo album filled with pictures of women. They were puzzled by the collection of books, most of which focused on different ways to perform strangulation and various types of poisons. A thorough investigation of the letters showed that they dated as far back as 1903, and that Kis had been misleading all of these women in an elaborate attempt to scam them with the intent of marriage and financial security. The correspondence was meticulously organized in 74 individual folders or packages, with each one representing an individual woman. All of the correspondence had been for women who happened to be looking to be married. Kis had placed several advertisements in local newspapers in and around Budapest with the intention of seeking women who were single and had no immediate family. Further analysis showed that Kis had received approximately 174 marriage proposals through posting the advertisements. He had offered to marry 74 of these women and maintained relationships with them through the mail. The police also noticed he used an alias in his correspondence, referring to himself as either Hoffman or Elmer when paying for the ads, and describing himself as a widower who was eagerly searching for female companionship. Nagy himself was clearly perplexed as to how Kis could maintain correspondence with so many women at the same time, even having them travel all the way to his house and not to have anyone in town, let alone his own housekeeper, notice or even be aware that something odd and sinister was taking place. When Nagy spoke to the townspeople, he was surprised that most of them had a very positive opinion about Kis. They mentioned that he was incredibly nice, very likable, and they were shocked to hear about such crimes. Yet, not all of Sinkota was enamored with Kis. There were a few residents who allegedly told Nagy that they felt very uncomfortable around him, and that he might have in fact been possessed by the devil, as they felt he had the ability to cast spells against individuals he disliked. Those neighbors were convinced that he had dabbled in sorcery and performed odd rituals, and they managed to stay far away from his house, claiming that the property was indeed cursed. Kis was extremely clever in creating his detailed advertisements, primarily in the personals, where in addition to seeking women in search of a husband, he asked prospective respondents to at least be financially secure. Many of these women that he preyed on were financially secure, but not necessarily the best looking, so they were desperate. To have such a handsome, charming man interested in marrying them, well, they practically fell at his feet. His typical plan was if he received a letter from a woman who lived nearby, he would travel to meet her and pamper her with much-needed attention and gifts. Once he got the relationship going, he would then coerce the women into sending him money as a manner of helping to secure a stable life with Keish. Many of these women, in fact, forwarded their entire life savings to him, and once they came to visit him in Sinkota, they would unfortunately be strangled and dumped into one of the drums or buried on the property, never to be seen or heard from again. This is why he insisted on the women not having any immediate family, so that once they disappeared, they wouldn't be missed at all. Attempts to find Keish at the front lines in the battle in World War I turned up very little. One time, Nagy received a letter on October 4, 1916, from a hospital in Serbia, that a soldier matching Keish's description had died from typhoid. Then later, another message reached Nagy, claiming that Keish was in fact alive and recuperating at the hospital. Confused by these conflicting reports, Nagy alerted Hungarian authorities and then proceeded to visit the hospital himself. It turned out that Keish was indeed alive and had in effect pulled a fast one on the authorities. When Nagy arrived, he discovered that Keish had escaped and used the body of a dead soldier to give Nagy the slip. Nagy and the doctors inspected the body and determined that it was not Keish. The body found at the hospital was of a much younger man in his 20s with blonde hair. Keish at this time would be in his late 30s or early 40s, leading the police to believe that Keish had switched papers with this soldier and perpetrated yet another hoax. It seemed quite apparent that Keish knew that the authorities were onto him, and throughout the entire manhunt, he always seemed to remain one step ahead of them. After the visit to the hospital, the police were bombarded by phone calls of numerous sightings of Keish. Each one was looked into, but they all turned up with nothing. Much like with all serial killers, Keish was becoming famous. More and more fictitious sightings were being reported in and around Budapest. One rumored sighting had Keish seen walking in Budapest right before the start of World War I with a striking young woman adorned in a fur coat. Another sighting had Keish boldly walking down the street in Budapest in 1919. A soldier claimed that Keish had been arrested in Romania for theft, while another story stated that he had succumbed to yellow fever while in Turkey. There were even more sightings over the years. In 1920, a member of the French Foreign Legion issued a report regarding another soldier who went by the name of Hoffman. Apparently, this Hoffman bragged endlessly to his fellow soldiers on his strangulation skills, especially how well-versed he was in using a garrote. Hoffman, also according to the soldier, bore a striking resemblance to Keish's description. Once the police arrived to question him, it was discovered that he had fled the unit, disappearing once again. The search for this Keish extended far into the 1930s, when a detective named Henry Oswald was convinced that he had seen Keish walking out of New York City's Times Square subway station in 1932. Oswald had a reputation for his keen observation and recognition of faces, so much so that he was nicknamed Camera Eye by his peers. Oswald was hampered from pursuing Keish as there were large crowds exiting the station. Yet, Oswald's sighting gave much hope that Keish was actually living in New York. Sometime later, another rumored New York sighting took place in 1936, where it was believed that Keish was working as a janitor in an apartment building. But by the time the police arrived to question him, he too had vanished. This was the last reported sighting of Keish. His whereabouts, still to this day, remain unknown. As time went on, other bodies turned up, but were they the victims of Keish? One woman's body that was found was the wife of a Viennese furrier. She was later identified by her wedding ring after her body was found in the woods. Rumor has it that she had abandoned her husband, taken all of her jewels and money, and run off with another man. Keesh had reportedly been seen in the same vicinity in the company of a young, unidentified woman who likely could have been the same. Another woman, Isabel Koblitz, who happened to be the niece of the Minister of Commerce, was reported missing in 1913. Her body was discovered in a field by farmers digging crops. No information exists on the condition of her body when it was found, or even how she was murdered. Another woman, Miss Reneker, was discovered in an abandoned well outside of Budapest 6 months earlier. She was originally from Switzerland, and the police were able to identify her body by a slightly deformed leg and a prominent scar on one of her cheeks. The police were baffled by these mysterious deaths, but they didn't have enough information to even make a connection with any possible perpetrators, including Keesh. For some time, any woman found dead was blamed on the monster of Cinquecento, and the legend of Keesh grew and grew. Many stories surrounding Keesh are merely urban legend. There are even some discrepancies in the actual true story about Keesh. There is some apparent confusion as to who originally discovered the notorious drums. One version involves soldiers who were scouring for fuel in Cinquecento when they asked the residents if anyone happened to have any extra fuel. They were told that Keesh had been hoarding fuel on his property and that he had been killed in the war. After being shown to his house, the soldiers found the drums. While it's not entirely clear if soldiers or the landlord actually discovered the bodies, it appears quite evident that the landlord was definitely the one who contacted the police upon the horrific discovery. Also perplexing are the notorious trips that Keesh allegedly took by car to Budapest in the middle of the night. Keesh's neighbors claim that they heard rattling about in the early morning hours, yet a rumor persists that the police interrogated Keesh about his trips. If so, did the inquiries take place after Keesh was questioned about the metal drums, or before? Then, there are the stories of Keesh being a vampire. Each of the victims were drained of their blood, with some, perhaps all, having puncture marks on their necks. Now, this aspect of the case has led to the urban legend that Keesh was indeed a vampire. Much of the vampire angle seems to be attributed to the specific folklore of the area. Yet if Keesh's victims were drained of their blood, it is a bit curious as to what he did with it. Did he drink it? Was it used as a form of sacrament in his alleged black magic rituals? Given his interest in the occult, this could have been possible. More likely, however, it seems that Keesh's decision to drain his victims' blood was part of his process in preserving his victims. There are even those who still believe that Keesh the vampire still haunts present-day Hungary and is still in search of new victims. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Man, like I said, we've never really done any serial killers on the show before, but I do think stories of, you know, serial killers and stuff like that sometimes are scary because, you know, we're always talking about mythical monsters or alleged monsters. You don't ever know.
Unproven stuff.
Unproven things. This is proven. Yeah. And the scary thing is with this guy is they never found him. And then there were sightings even in the United States.
Yeah.
Like maybe he immigrated over from Hungary and was seen on the streets of New York. Maybe he killed more women. I mean, look, the 24 that they found in those drums, that's just the ones they found. He might be more responsible for who knows what. And you also got to remember the time period, early 20th century. It was way easier to get away with stuff than nowadays. I mean, now every street corner's got a camera on it. Every intersection,
well, also,
you know what I mean?
You didn't have like a driver's license with your photo on it and all that stuff. You just went by what you said your name was.
Yeah.
And how you signed in. I'm glad you did this. I know there's been we've gotten a lot of emails about people asking us to kind of foray off into the real creepy, like true crime stories. And we never did.
No.
But also, too, the name of the show is Expanded Perspectives. We did that for a reason. We made it so we could do stories of other things, not necessarily ufology or cryptozoology, to put a spin on these very dark, creepy stories. I mean, we, you know, we did the what is it, the Heidler Fink murders or whatnot, where they saw the devil's prince they believe was a serial killer. This is one of those ones, man, that's unnerving. And what makes it so unnerving is, like you said, they never caught him.
Yeah.
They never know what happened to him. Just like you and I'd watched the documentary, what is it, H.H.R. Holmes. And
yeah.
And I mean, it's, there's a lot of,
well, there's a common thread in a lot of these serial killers. Most of the time, they're very intelligent.
Yes.
They're, lots of times, they're very good looking.
Yes.
And I mean, this guy's story kind of sounds like Ted Bundy. I mean, he was able to woo women with his charms and his good looks.
That proves,
you know,
it, folks, that Kyle and I would never be serial killers. We're out on those two things.
Right.
We're not intelligent, and we're damn sure not good looking. Kyle, I got a question for you.
Sure.
You ever had deja vu?
Yeah.
You ever wondered what caused it?
Possible time slip, I guess, is all I ever thought. Well, you ever had Vuja Day? That's where none of this ever seems like it's happened
before. That happens to me daily. This comes from Science Daily. As a matter of fact, Texas A&M actually did a study. It says this is what the summary starts out as. What causes deja vu? It says you walk into a room and suddenly your brain goes fuzzy with an overwhelming wave of familiarity, although this is a totally new experience. It says like something out of a sci-fi plot. It almost seems as if you've walked into the future. And a new study is shining a spotlight on that very thing known as deja vu. This is, chances are, of course, you've experienced it. But what they think it is this. This is Michelle Hook, PhD, assistant professor in the Department of Neuroscience and Experimental Therapeutics at the Texas A&M Health Center College of Medicine. Because there is no clear, identifiable stimulus that elicits a deja vu experience, it is a retrospective report from an individual. She said it is a very difficult thing to study deja vu in a laboratory. She goes on to say that according to many studies, approximately 2/3 of individuals have experienced at least one episode of deja vu in their life. Understanding how the memory storage works may shed some light on why some experience it more than others. Now, they believe that there's some shortcuts like that in the neural pathways. Some really strange things. It says epileptic seizures are characterized by dysfunctional neuron or nerve cell activities across the brain, which disrupts the electrical impulses that fire the neurons. They believe there's a tie-in that findings suggest that deja vu events may be caused by electrical malfunctions in the brain. So what they're trying to say is this. You're really not having what we consider deja vu. It's a misfire in your brain that makes you think that you're having a familiarity. She says this, that some suggest that when a difference in processing occurs along these pathways, the perception is disrupted and is experienced as two separate messages. The brain interprets the second version through the slowed secondary pathway as a separate perceptual experience, and thus the inappropriate feeling of familiarity occurs.
Yeah.
So that's what it is. Now, she goes on.
That's interesting, right?
According to Dr. Hook, there's still much to learn about deja vu and the mechanisms behind it. Now, she says that there may not be a simple answer for the mechanisms behind deja vu yet, but with further research and studies, conclusive evidence for the phenomenon may be discovered in the future. Now, wouldn't that be like experiencing deja vu all over again? Now, that's a little tag that she uses.
Right.
I believe, who was it? Yogi Berra. It's like deja vu all over again.
That was right,
But it's funny. But it makes sense that maybe there's a misfire. Maybe there's something going on. There's a misfire in your brain at that one point. There's so much going on up there. And your brain tricks itself into thinking that you're having something happen familiar. Now, that is just simply the scientific explanation for what they think is going on. I've heard people say that it could be something from the past lives.
Yeah.
Here's the thing with this. Being that it is something electrical going on in your brain, if that's what it is, then it's like an emotion, and it feels so real to the human experiencer right now. If it happened, it would feel so real that you would argue that it was a memory from something else.
Right.
So it's going to be very hard unless you could plan when somebody could experience it or put something on them to cause them to experience. But even that happening, that's changing the experiment. If you cause somebody right. to have deja vu, that's not the same as walking into some new place 9 states away and having deja vu.
Right. Well, that's not what I always say, man. Is these people that have experiences, whether it's a UFO or extraterrestrial experience, a Sasquatch encounter, whatever mm-hmm. experience they have, if they truly feel like they had it, it doesn't matter if it really happened or not, because it's the same experience. You're walking away from it. Like, yes. say you hallucinated a yes. Sasquatch in the woods. It still affected you the same as if it really was there. So
that
it doesn't,
is
at the end of the day, it
you.
Doesn't matter. Right.
You're
it's
right.
Like, it has the same effect.
Well, and like we've discussed, you run into so many people that whether you believe their story or not, they believe it, and it's changed their life. It doesn't matter if it happened for real or if it was all a hallucination at all. It's changed that person.
Well, that's why so people happened. Say, I know that that guy's lying. He didn't experience that. You can never say that.
No.
Because I wasn't there. So that's
yeah.
all I can say. If you're new to the show, welcome. We really enjoy you being here. We are Expanded Perspectives. We do shows on UFOs, ancient history, alternative history, cryptozoology, and of course now serial killers. We're glad that you're here. If you're not familiar, we have a website, expandedperspectives.com. If you'd like to share your story, you can email us at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. And then don't forget, if you really like the show, you can always write us a review on iTunes. You can find us on every podcatcher. You can find us on YouTube. You can follow the show on Facebook, Twitter. You know the deal. If you'd like to call and leave your story, 817-945-3828. And don't forget, we have another show called Expanded Perspectives Elite. That show comes out every Thursday most of the time, unless we're caught on the road traveling. Sometimes it's delayed just a little bit. But you can go to the website and find out all stuff about that. Cam?
Yes, sir.
You got any big plans this week other than trying to get over these colds we have?
I've got so much work to do this week. My wife is out of town for the week. I'm going to be busy with my daughter and I are going to be busy. I've got to take my mother to go have some kind of eye surgery this week. So, man, I've got so much stuff going on. It is going to be ridiculous. I'm also working on some videos as we speak.
Yeah.
You know, you and I are going through all new editing software. And, I mean, we're, man, you know what? Several years ago, I would have never believed I'd have been into this kind of stuff and really got into it.
Right.
And it's basically like going back to school all over again to try to learn this stuff. Any of you graphic designers and all you people that do all of this with this fancy stuff on computers now, my hat's off to you, because that's a lot to learn. I used to think it was a joke. I used to sit there and be like, this is a joke, what these guys do and these girls do. I'm like, come on, you're playing on a computer. Boy, was I wrong, and I'm sorry for thinking that. I mean, it is a lot of work, a lot of stress, and there's so much, man. I'm just like, whew. So, yeah, it's right. like learning something new all over again. But I'm enjoying it, so we'll see what happens.
Well, that's cool. I got a whole pile of new books that were delivered here recently, and I've been going through those. Some pretty interesting ones, actually. I need to talk to you off air about some of them, about possibly getting some new guests on.
Yeah, I'm down.
I hope everybody has a really good week. Don't work too hard. For you Elite members, we'll be talking to you on Thursday. For everybody else, have a good week, folks. We'll speak to you next Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.